Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Anna Mateo, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
Across Africa, men carrying tools for cutting down trees spend weeks deep inside forests. They cut down the trees to burn them in order to make fuel for fires known as charcoal. Because they work at night, mainly on public land, they operate without fear of the law while destroying forests in many countries. Fires in Brazil's Amazon rainforest have brought attention to the difficulties of protecting the Earth's forest lands. The Congo Basin tropical rainforest is about the size of Western Europe. After the Amazon, it is the world's second largest rainforest. Some people call it Earth's second lung. Africa is home to over 1.2 billion people, and poverty on the continent remains a problem. Many nations have struggled to protect forests as growing populations demand plant-based energy resources that are considered low cost. Charcoal is widely used. The European Space Agency says that 25 to 35% of climate-changing greenhouse gases come from biomass burning. Biomass burning is natural or man-made burning of organic material, including seasonal fires people set to clear land for farming. Most of this kind of burning happens in tropical areas of Africa. A 2018 report from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization found dependence on charcoal or firewood to be highest in Africa and Asia. Some African cities are almost completely dependent on charcoal for cooking. In Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, 90% of residents depend on it, the report said.
In Somalia, the UN has warned that cutting down trees to support an illegal charcoal trade is so widespread that desertification there threatens stability. The country is already suffering a wave of extremist violence. The UN report said that the estimated value of the charcoal export trade from East Africa to the Middle East and other places is over $360 million a year. This is the case although the trade is banned. About 8.2 million trees were cut down for charcoal between 2011 and 2017, the UN said. Ugandan government officials have warned about the charcoal trade for a long time. The trade continues, although the electrical power system now extends deep into the country. Hydroelectric power is still too costly for many people, even in the capital, Kampala. Edwin Muhamuza is an environmental activist who runs the group Youth Go Green in Kampala. He told the Associated Press that charcoal has become a valuable product, like gold or coffee. "We are really concerned," he said. "They cut down the trees, but they don't replace them." Now, the National Environment Management Authority, a government agency, is urging officials to lift taxes on liquid petroleum gas. It is another cooking fuel that could be used instead of charcoal. Research shows a difficult situation. Uganda's forest cover, as a percentage of land area, was 9% in 2015. Government data shows that is down from 24% in 1990.
But officials in northern parts of Uganda, such as Gulu, which provides much of the charcoal entering Kampala, are taking action. Their campaign has seized many charcoal trucks since 2015. Gulu chairman Martin Mapinduzi organizes raids in hopes of arresting charcoal burners. Illegal logging has gone down, but the destruction of forests for charcoal burning is still high, Mapinduzi said. It's something that is giving us a lot of headache, but we are fighting. The price of enough charcoal to support a small family for several weeks has been rising in Kampala. In August, it reached about $28. That is largely because of reduced supply from places such as Gulu. The cost is still far too much for families, said Rose Twine. She is a businesswoman who sells a cooking device called the Eco Stove. Twine says one Eco Stove comes with volcanic rocks that she said can last for up to 2 years. It costs $110. Yearly charcoal costs for an average family can grow to more than $300. Charcoal is actually not cheaper, Twine said. People are just stuck in their old ways. Widespread destruction of forests has led to campaigns to take action in some African countries.
This week, Gabon became the first African country to receive payments for provable efforts to reduce greenhouse gases resulting from the destruction of forests. The UN Development Program said payments would reach $150 million over 10 years. It called the payments historic in many ways. In July, the UN Environment Program said that Ethiopia's prime minister led an effort in which over 350 million trees were planted across the country in one day. But some activists say tree planting may not be enough to save Africa's forests. They urge governments to spend more on alternative energy sources for the poorest people. Mapinduzi, the Ugandan official campaigning against charcoal burning, called for laws against it and urged officials to make electricity cheaper. Others also believe only urgent action, such as a ban on the charcoal trade, will help. A total ban, said activist Muhumuza. 100%. I'm Ana Mateo.
And I'm Pete Musto.
American scientists have reported the first successful sexual reproduction of Atlantic coral in a laboratory setting. Researchers at the Florida Aquarium in Tampa recently announced their results. They described them as a scientific breakthrough. Scientists believe the reproduction method could help save Atlantic corals in danger of disappearing completely. Corals are groups of small organisms called polyps. These polyps live within a hard skeleton made of limestone. Millions of corals grow together to form coral reefs. The reefs support many kinds of sea life. Coral reefs also support fishing activities and protect inland waterways. Corals can reproduce either asexually or sexually. Asexually, new small polyps break off from parent polyps to expand or begin new colonies. This process is also known as fragmentation. In sexual reproduction, some corals produce sperm and eggs and release them into the water. The eggs and sperm join to form free-floating larvae. The larvae are either fertilized within the body of a polyp or in the water in a process called spawning. The laboratory experiment at the Florida Aquarium involved inducing corals to release their eggs and sperm in laboratory tanks. Scientists in other countries have reported similar success, but the Florida Aquarium's experiment was a first for the United States. The Florida team cooperated with researchers from the Britain-based Horniman Museum and Gardens, which has successfully induced spawning of different kinds of Pacific coral. In order for the experiment to be a success, scientists had to control the tank to create conditions as similar as possible to a natural ocean environment. The Florida Aquarium team spent months doing this. The effort included changing the temperatures in summer and winter and using technology to recreate sun and moon activity. Such conditions serve as biological signs for the organisms that it is time to spawn. Kerry O'Neill is a senior coral scientist at the Florida Aquarium. She said the massive and fully synchronized spawning was a success because it happened at exactly the predicted time for wild spawning. She added that by creating the right conditions, you can change the game for coral restoration. We'll be able to do this for dozens of species, and it opens up a world of new possibilities, O'Neill told Reuters news agency. The scientists plan to use the method to spawn new coral colonies to help repopulate Florida's struggling coral reefs. The reef system is one of the largest in the world, but it has suffered years of damage from climate change, pollution, and disease. Amelia Mora is the science program manager for the Florida-based Coral Restoration Foundation. The organization carries out its own major fragmentation programs. This involves farming large numbers of corals that are later outplanted to the reef. Mora told VOA there are many causes for the widespread destruction of Atlantic coral. All, however, are linked to climate change.
Our corals, like many around the world, are at risk of, you know, warming waters and ocean acidification, all which come under the large umbrella of climate change.
In addition, she said Florida coral is also currently suffering from a massive disease outbreak, likely related to poor quality water flowing into the ocean. Mora said it was really exciting to learn about the successful spawning of Atlantic coral. She said the results were especially important because they happened with pillar coral. This kind of coral has a more complex reproductive process than other species. She added that there are very few adult colonies of this coral species still living. So the new laboratory spawning can make a huge difference in coral restoration efforts in Florida and elsewhere.
The new influx of genetic material is really critical to the success of this species long term.
I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. As president, John Adams was head of the Federalist Party, but the power of that position really belonged to former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. For this and other reasons, Adams did not like Hamilton. He said he would rather be a minister to Europe under Jefferson than a president controlled by Hamilton. Hamilton did not like Adams either. Hamilton did everything he could to block Adams from becoming president again. He gave his support to another Federalist candidate, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina. Under the electoral system at that time, the candidate with the most votes became president. The candidate with the second highest number of votes became vice president. A Federalist victory in the election of 1800 would not be easy. The Republicans had a very strong and popular candidate in Thomas Jefferson. So Federalist Party leaders attempted to change the electoral system. The Constitution said state legislatures were to choose electors to vote for president. The Federalists tried to gain control over the legislature's decisions. They wanted Congress to create a special committee to rule if an elector had or did not have the right to vote. The committee could say if an elector's vote should be counted or thrown away. The committee would have 6 members from the Senate and 6 members from the House of Representatives. The 13th member would be the Chief Justice of the United States. Creating such a committee violated the Constitution. Federalist leaders knew this, so they wanted Congress to approve the committee, but keep the measure secret until after the election. The Federalists held a majority of seats in the Senate, and the Senate voted to approve the proposal. But some Federalist members of the House of Representatives denounced it. They made many changes in the proposal. The Senate refused to accept the changes. Without agreement by both houses of Congress, the bill died. Federalist leaders saw their hopes for an election victory begin to disappear. By the summer of 1800, Thomas Jefferson's Republican Party had strong leaders in every state. It had many newspapers to express party ideas. Jefferson decided to take a holiday at Monticello, his farm in Virginia. The Republican Party leader in New York was a lawyer, Aaron Burr. Burr had served as an officer under General George Washington during America's war for independence from Britain. After the war, he joined the Federalist Party and was elected to the United States Senate. Later, he changed parties and became a Republican. In 1800, a group of both Federalists and Republicans supported him as a candidate for president. Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton were bitter enemies. When Hamilton learned of his own party's support for electing Burr, his reaction was quick and sharp. "Anybody," he said, "even Thomas Jefferson, is better than Aaron Burr. Jefferson is not dangerous. Burr is. Jefferson's ideas of government are wrong, but at least he is an honest man. Burr is a man without honesty and character. He will destroy America," Hamilton said. The president elected in 1800 would govern from a new capital city. The national government would move from Philadelphia to Washington, a newly built city in the District of Columbia. It was along the Potomac River between the states of Maryland and Virginia. When President Adams and his wife Abigail arrived in Washington, they found a frontier town. There were few houses or streets. Mrs. Adams could not believe what she saw. She wrote to her daughter, "This is a city only because we call it a city. Our house here is very big, but the rooms are not finished. There is almost no furniture. There are not enough lamps for light." John Adams also wrote to his wife about the house where the president would live. In a letter, he asked heaven to bless the house and whoever lived in it. A later president asked for Adams' blessing to be carved above a fireplace.
There is a mantle there with an inscription from John Adams saying, "May all future residents of this house be virtuous creatures."
Joseph Ellis is a historian and the author of many books about America's founding fathers. He says John Adams' words can still be found in the White House today. A street called Pennsylvania Avenue went from the president's house to the Capitol building where Congress would meet. On each side of the street, where buildings stand today, there were fields of mud. This was the new federal city, the new capital of the United States. This was where the winner of the presidential election of 1800 would begin his term of office. John Ferling taught American history at the University of West Georgia. He says Jefferson's party campaigned better and listened to the concerns of ordinary people.
The Republicans, the Jeffersonians, understood the American political process, the more democratic process that was coming into being, better than the Federalists did, and it enabled them to win a couple of key states, and that spelled doom for Adams.
George Washington won America's first two presidential elections without opposition. John Adams won the third presidential election by 3 electoral votes. This time, in 1800, there was no clear winner. When the electors' votes were counted, President Adams had 65 votes. But Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr each had 73 votes. So under the Constitution, the House of Representatives would have to choose between Jefferson and Burr, the candidates with the highest number of votes. Each congressman could vote, but each state had just one vote. That vote would go to the candidate supported by a majority of congressmen from the state. A candidate had to receive a majority of the state votes to win. In 1800, that meant 9 of the 16 states. The Federalists saw the situation as their last chance to control the presidency. They had two plans. They would try to block the Congress from electing either Jefferson or Burr as president. Then they would try to find a way to put executive power in the hands of a Federalist. If that plan failed, they were prepared to elect Burr. The Federalists tried to make people believe that Burr was working with them against Jefferson. Burr denied this. In a letter to Jefferson, Burr wrote, "Every Republican wants you to be president of the United States. Every good Republican wants to serve under you. I would be happy and honored to be your vice president. And if you believe I could help you better in some other position, I would do so." On February 11th, the House of Representatives began to count votes state by state. 8 states chose Jefferson. 6 chose Burr. The representatives of 2 states, Maryland and Vermont, gave each man an equal number of votes. There was no majority within those states, so neither man won the votes of those states. The voting continued. All that day and throughout the night, the representatives voted. 27 times, the count remained the same. 8 states for Jefferson, 6 for Burr, 2 undecided. The next morning, the representatives decided to rest for 4 hours. The voting began again at noon. There was no change. The 13th of February passed, then the 14th and 15th. Still no change. The House voted 33 times. It could not elect a president. A change in the vote of just one congressman from Maryland or Vermont could decide the contest. Later, after the election, the representative from Delaware said he had met with 2 congressmen from Maryland and 1 from Vermont. All were Federalists. All had voted for Aaron Burr. The Delaware congressman said, "They claimed they spoke with a friend of Thomas Jefferson." He said they told Jefferson's friend they would change their votes if Jefferson made certain promises. Jefferson denied that he had made any political promises. He said many men tried to get promises from him, but he said he told all of them that he would never become president with his hands tied. The House of Representatives voted for the 36th time on February 17th. 10 states, including Maryland and Vermont, voted for Thomas Jefferson. 4 states voted for Aaron Burr. 2 states, Delaware and South Carolina, did not vote. But Jefferson had the majority he needed.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.